Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Katie O'Malley might be the first journalist in Canada to ever get paid to tweet. She's paid primarily to tweet. She is the Ottawa Citizen's online mobile team journalist. They describe her as Canada's first mobile-focused political journalist. She also writes in the paper. She's a fixture, whether you're a journalist on Parliament Hill or if you follow Canadian news and politics online. You cannot avoid Katie O'Malley, and you don't want to. She has 65,000 followers. She has tweeted almost 200,000 times. She's doing an old job in a new way, and I had a chance to speak with her just a few days after the Liberals' surprise majority victory on her home turf in Ottawa. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Pat Bolduc, John Ashton, James Clifford, Fraser Hayes, Bernie Perusse, Laura Daw, Ali Kadir, Cami Johnson, and Alyssa McLeod. Alyssa, why did you decide to be awesome?
Because I believe that an independent media free of government or corporate influence is essential to a healthy democracy.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
This episode is also brought to you by CJFE. Canadian Journalists for Free Expression are mounting a legal challenge, a charter rights challenge to Bill C-51, along with the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Who do you think has the best chance of challenging Bill C-51, the new Liberal government or CJFE? I don't know. My money might be on CJFE. Maybe yours should be too. But CJFE doesn't just do major projects like that to extend your free expression here in Canada. They also help out when journalists get in trouble overseas. I asked Tom Hennifer, who runs CJFE, what kind of stuff they do.
Overseas, we assist journalists in distress, journalists who are facing death threats, are facing jail terms. We pay for legal defense. We pay to have them relocated to other countries, to safe countries. We pay to pay for emergency surgery and other medical expenses in some cases.
Listen, I volunteer for CJFE. I am a member. You should become a member too. Go to cjfe.org. Click Become a Member and find out about the perks and pub nights with journalists and the annual review, all of which you will get when you join me and become a member. Membership is reduced drastically for listeners of this podcast. cjfe.org. Do it.
What even happened? Where are we now? What is going on? I'm sorry to open up with a Grandpa Simpson-like question, but I feel like the universe has shifted in some way that I have yet to comprehend. I've been in a daze since Monday.
I think we're all still trying to kind of figure out what this all means, mostly because even when you looked at the polls coming into this weekend, I think, well, I can only speak for myself and, you know, the people that I was talking to, but I think we all kind of expected a minority. We didn't know whose minority, and it started to look more and more likely towards the end that it would be a Liberal minority. But that's a different headspace to be in when you're kind of anticipating that, because you're also sort of mentally planning the constitutional, you know, crisis, and then the aftermath, and then the thing, I lived through two minorities, the thing where every budget bill, every money bill, every throne speech bill, there's this constant threat that the government will fall and you'll be put into an election. And I've been getting, I think all of us have sort of been getting our heads ready for that. And then we end up with a majority and it's like, well, this is weird. So this is our thing for the next 4 years. So what now?
Because you must have been on hold all summer. Everything was happening throughout.
Yeah.
And then you had a very real possibility that 4 or 5 months from now, we do this all again.
Right. And again, living through two minorities, including actually two surprisingly long-lived minorities, we went through a whole lot of will there or won't they election crises, particularly the second time around. There was a sort of mindset you went into where you knew always that 6 months, you couldn't plan a vacation more than maybe 2 months ahead of time. And even that, you were kind of tempting the fates because there was always the possibility that you could have a snap confidence vote that things could come down and that you were going to be in an election. And it was a very weird way to live. We then had, you know, 4 years of majority. And I think a lot of us were kind of expecting, you know, well, that was nice. Now let's get back into minority time.
It feels like there's like a pause for like deep reflection and to, you know, and even within everybody who I think we've been running from story to story, from talking point to talking point. I mean, it's been a very dramatic and I think pretty nasty process. I wonder to what extent the response like puts to rest a lot of the things that we get obsessed with. There was a larger story going on in people's minds of just enough change.
Yeah, I think it's true. And it's so trite to say that, you know, the election, you know, change versus not change. And I think that if you kind of look back, there were all these sort of subplots. There was, you know, the NICAB, which we will not soon forget that episode in Canadian politics. There was the debate over the debates. Remember that?
Yeah.
There was, you know, oh no, Justin Trudeau is not going to balance budgets. He's lost the election. It's kind of fun to go back and look at how many times various, you know, media outlets and pundits and other parties declared that the Liberals had lost the elections. It was like a weekly occurrence. It was like, well, there they go. They were contenders, but then they said that thing about small business and now it's all over. So I think it's been kind of a humbling experience as far as that goes for all of us in terms of our skills at soothsaying the future.
Are we like taking that to heart? Like, I include myself in this. I think that, you know, you get into a lifestyle of like, what's hot, what's new, what am I on now? And, you know, is that even a lesson that can be beat into our heads? You know, that hot moment is often like not just revealing, but actually could obscure what's really going on.
I think the trick is to really appreciate the hot moment and to boggle over it and say, oh my gosh, this is a hot moment. Here are the things that are happening. But to at all times try so hard to resist the temptation of saying, and that means we're going to go to this next moment and this next moment. And before you know it, you've sort of planned out 6 months in advance. And that's not always the way it goes. So it's important to kind of observe and be in the moment. And sure, I mean, a little speculation is fine, but always keep your mind focused on the fact that you could be completely wrong about everything.
Yeah.
And you have to be ready to be flexible and jump onto that new thing that's actually happening rather than doggedly pursuing what you think, you know, the dreaded narrative.
I mean, one thing that I kind of realized looking back on the last couple of months is the extent to which we just took marching orders on what we should be talking about on any given day, you know?
The economy. We're always supposed to be talking about the economy.
Yeah. Or it was very clear, like we were just, I mean, and a lot of this did come from Harper, where, okay, I'm making this an issue. I'm making that an issue. I'm doubling down on this. And everyone just sort of, you know, I mean, and it's not like he had complete autonomous control over that because it could come from Duffy. It could come externally. But is there anything to be taken away from this about like, well, did we serve people properly? Like, should we have exerted more of a guiding hand? I'm like, you know what? We're going to ignore that. We don't have to talk about the Nakab for the next, you know.
I'm always a fan of occasionally saying, you know what? Enough. Putting out a press release does not actually dictate that I have to treat this as news. I almost think, however, at the same time, you know, your readers and your audience, they need to be served by you actually covering what's going on. So I think in a perfect world, and obviously we don't live in a perfect world where media outlets have endless resources to spend on this stuff, but it would be really interesting to almost have a two-stream approach to election coverage. You have one team that is actually doing the this is what happened, these are the leaders, this is the interplay, because that is all important. It is all exciting, and it's you know, very, you have to adapt very quickly to kind of that changing pace.
It's like sports.
At the same time, yeah,
and
exactly.
That's fun.
But at the same time, you could also have a team that was kind of looking at other issues, looking at the way voters are reacting, looking at policy stuff that they feel. Vice is a good example of a media outlet that actually did a pretty good job of First Nations issues, and they kind of picked a few things that they wanted to focus on.
They championed some stuff.
And they stuck to those, which is, you know, it might be easier in their particular line of work because they don't have to be all things to all people. People reading Vice for their election coverage were perfectly happy to get what Vice thought was really great news. But I suspect most of those people were also, you know, checking out what was in the other media outlets just to make sure they didn't miss anything. It means everything's complementary. Like, it all kind of works together. But it is it would be interesting to see if that would end up producing a more of a mix in terms of intensity of the coverage.
That's an interesting thing that you suggest there, that, like, I mean, yeah, nobody's getting like what's happening today in politics from Vice, but they pick some territory and they make a niche out of it. And then I'm looking at the media's response, and then like the National Observer's looking, well, what does this mean for the oil industry and the environment? And if the way that new organizations kind of carve out their turf is by specializing like that, because, you know, you say earlier that, you know, maybe we should have two teams. Mm-hmm. The mainstream media always has two teams. They had the opinionators and the columnists.
It's very true.
The analysts. And then they had people on the ground doing the reporting. But there's almost like a weird information loop between those where there was, you know, yes, you're getting an editorial as a part from a piece of reporting, but they just feed directly into each other.
You don't always get to do the other. One thing that I did, I guess it would have been maybe 2 weeks ago. No, it was right after the Liberal platform launch. So it would have been, yeah, I guess about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. I actually looked at what they were doing on Democratic reform. Specifically the things they were doing in the House of Commons, which for me, I'm obsessed with parliamentary stuff and procedure and kind of how the actual workings of Parliament go.
Yeah.
So I just ignored everything else that day. There were probably, well, of course, there would have been the daily feedings. There would have been the press conferences. I'm sure there were issues that arose. I ignored that for the day, and I just like focused on this separate thing and kind of did my best at analyzing and sort of putting out what I thought the pros and cons and kind of the realistic and not so realistic aspects of it. So you can't, no one has the luxury of being able to do that all the time, but I think that I am lucky to have, you know, have bosses that will give me the freedom of saying, know what? I'm just going to like tune out from this main event for like a day or two and do this other thing because I think this other thing is going to lead to something very interesting.
And nerd out on parliamentary procedure.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of, you know, and again, I'm not talking about disappearing for weeks at a time and then, you know, coming back with maybe 200 words on something. But sometimes it is good to be able to kind of pause and get away from the constant and just sort of look at something else. It's harder during an election because you're always... what is it? The fear of missing out. It is in media. We have our own sort of our very own specialized FOMO, which is we are always worried that while we're looking over here, they're going to be doing something. Something is going to be happening over in the other place that we will feel like idiots for not covering. So it becomes a very very frenzied way of approaching
it. But it's a weird double-sided fear of missing out. You know, you're afraid that when you're focusing on one thing, you're going to miss the other thing. But then you're afraid. I mean, I just know this. It's at story meetings every morning. It's just like, how are we not going to talk about, you know, whatever? Like, I open up the Arrival paper. I listen to the Arrival broadcast. They're talking about this. And there's still this concept that people are listening to the one broadcast and not the other, the one newspaper, not the other. It's almost like an algorithm that's broken, which is like somebody reads it in the Globe and Mail or whatever, CBC. Okay, what's our take on this? Mm-hmm. Well, what does your take have to be on that?
Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. But we are a competitive industry at the same time as we're all sort of covering the same thing. And
we're competitive for weird reasons. Don't you think, like, is it actually like the news consumer is going to judge one, like the Globe and Mail's coverage of that day of the Duffy trial against the National Post coverage of that day of the Duffy trial. Like, it's better
I wear my news consumer hat, I look forward to both of them. I really want to read what the Globe has to say, and then I really want to read what the National Post has to say, and then I want to go look at like every other piece of coverage I can find.
I only do if they actually, you know, if somebody's like, okay, well, let's take a different angle, or let's find something new about it. And if you can't, or if that's sort of diminishing returns, it's like, well, just look at something else. There's a million things you could be looking at.
There really are. But yeah, we feel compelled to, you know, treat our reader as if they're in a bomb shelter and the only publication they get a day is whatever we're handing them. And
with fewer resources than ever before. So those redundancies are actually quite costly.
If I were running a media outlet, maybe I would have more of a sense of how to go about, you know, dealing with that. But hey, I just write my stuff and do my things. And I am happy to say that there are a whole lot of news outlets in Canada and I pretty much enjoy reading all of them.
Apart from the resource management side of it, I kind of had this moment where I was like, oh, I just realized the extent to which the way that I engage with a topic is dictated by like outside forces and not like the media, but politics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I opened the paper like, wow, Justin fucking Trudeau is the next prime minister. And it hit me for the first time, like, that's so weird. It was so determined by this, oh, he's not ready thing or trying to make him into a clown. Mm-hmm. And that's so politicized that I don't think we ever had a national debate around the idea of dynasty. Like, I'm not so big on dynasty. Like, I wasn't big on W. And it's pretty obvious, I think, without taking anything away from the guy, that it's not by any, you know, accomplishment, you know, that this is particular. He needs to be named Trudeau to have gotten the opportunity when he did. And there's a conversation about, are we like, what is it about people that's a big plus, you know?
Well, it's an interesting question. If he were named Justin Trudeau and he were Paul Calandra, for example, would we be, you know, would it all have sort of transpired as it did? I think it becomes impossible to like separate the sort of legacy from the actual guy. But at the same time, the trouble with dynasties is, okay, what are we going to do? Are we going to, like, you know, put generational term limits? Are we going to say that, you know, once one member of a family has come to a position of high office, then, you know, not their children, maybe the grandchildren are allowed back in the ring? It becomes really difficult.
And I'm getting the sense that you and I are very different thinkers. No, it's not a policy question. I just, like, what is it about people that we, like kings or we like the son of? That's a weird thing that, you know, I don't think we ever actually, you know, because it felt like you were giving a point to the other side for those who wanted change, you know, that never actually got hashed out. And, you know, I think a lot more of the guy than I did at the beginning of the campaign, but you know, that's almost a separate issue from just, that's so strange.
Yeah.
It could have been anyone out of 35 million people. We chose that guy.
It is a weird thing that happened, but you know, I mean, you kind of saw it happening through the Liberal leadership. And then there were many, many, many moments along there where it looked like it was going to, Canadians were resoundingly not going to choose, you know, the party headed up by Justin Trudeau. So, you know, it was kind of a high risk, high potential gain strategy for the Liberals, and they managed to luck out on it.
I actually think, like, you know, Jerry Butts for prime minister, like, that, like
That seems like that guy.
Hey, Katie Telford, man.
Yeah.
Katie Telford for prime minister.
Yeah, I think it's one of those situations where people are like, he's got some good people around him. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's kind of crossing their fingers that he has some good people around him.
Well, and I mean, that's, to be fair, that's also true for both, you know, for Tom Mulcair and for Stephen Harper. You don't get to that position. You don't get anywhere near that position without having some people around you that are really, really good at that stuff. No one is a one-man band prime minister or one-woman band prime minister.
Yeah.
Even Elizabeth May has advisors.
Sure.
And she's, you know, probably the closest of any of them to someone who can almost do it all herself. But you need the team approach. You just can't do it all by yourself.
Yeah, no, that she's the closest to sort of an indie rock kind of thing.
Yeah.
But after, like, Ignatieff, you had to wonder, like, wow, nobody knows what they're doing over there. And so I guess somebody did this time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess third strike.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting to imagine because, again, there were many points along the election where it looked like the Liberals were just going to go right over the cliff.
Wasn't this so consequential? Like, if this went the way that we thought it was going to and it was Mulcair's,
yeah,
like, that would have been it for, forget Trudeau, the party.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. Like, this was kind of their last, you know, their last chance.
And instead it's a majority. Like, that's a pretty big swing.
Yeah. I'm sure Michael Ignatieff is kind of gazing at the results and wondering, you know, what was it? Why wasn't I that guy?
He needed the goatee.
Perhaps that was it.
Yeah.
The tattoo.
Here's another Grandpa Simpson kind of question. What do you do? Like, what is your job? Because you sort of are the first person maybe to ever have your particular version of your job.
I mean, in one sense, I do. I cover politics. I look at what's going on. I try to figure out my own angle. I try to figure out questions that people need answers. And then I do my best to kind of write it up in a way that's going to be both interesting and informative, I hope. I take it as kind of a challenge to grab something that's maybe not, you know, seen as super fascinating, like political financing or, you know, or election law, and try to get people excited about it. That's always kind of the challenge, right, is to get people interested in what you're covering. You know, on a daily basis, I when I wake up in the morning, I never know for sure most likely what I'm going to be doing that day. It tends to be in the next couple of hours that something either comes up and, you know, I want to write about it, or my bosses are like, hey, here's a thing. What do you think of this thing? Do you have things to say on this thing? And then, you know, can kind of get into it. I mean, it will, of course, be very different when Parliament gets back because it does become the beast that dictates much of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We live by the bells just like everyone else. The MPs keep you hopping and you really never know what you're going to be doing at any given time. That's the case even in majority. So I suspect that I will find myself covering a lot more committees, covering a lot more House battles, covering a lot more Parliament when we finally have a Parliament again. So it's been interesting not having that. I kind of miss it.
We're a few years past the point where it's sort of gee whiz, she uses Twitter. But I think that
gosh,
it's...
Gosh, I hope so.
Those stories are... You're glad to be past them, I'm sure. But I think what's unique about your space amongst parliamentary reporters is that, like, it almost feels like digital is your primary platform.
It is my primary platform,
like that, and that's actually official in your job.
Yeah,
title.
That is. I'm mobile first. I, like, legitimately am. That's my primary goal.
Like, when you're tweeting, you're doing your job.
Yeah, well, I'm also, usually I'm tweeting and then I put head down and I write, you know, something up for the app. And sometimes it makes it into the paper, sometimes it doesn't. My job is to make sure that, you know, readers there are fed. Tweeting is, it's my job, but it's also, I just like to hear what people have to say. And, you know, and sometimes bounce stuff around. I'm a communicative person. It's a good way of kind of, back in the day when I was at McLean's, when we were both at McLean's, do you remember... We were like the only we seemed like the only media outlet where we actually had a comment threads that were really interesting. They were filled with really interesting people. The writers, all of us would like actually participate in the discussion. We'd participate in each other's comment threads.
I can probably remember the names of some of those comments.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And to me, Twitter is a little bit like that because you do get to have that feedback. And there are a lot of very, you know, interesting, funny, smart, insightful, wise people that you can sort of glom on to what they have to say. And it really sort of, it shrinks the world and makes it bigger at the same time. So I can't, it's difficult to imagine covering politics without it now, just simply because you have all of that, you know, that input and that it's not only you taking your message and your news to the world, but it's sort of sucking it in as well. So it's become it's just become so key to what we do, I think.
It was sort of Pollyannish because what I was writing about from McLean's at the time was like, oh, the people formerly known as the audience and it's a conversation now. Those were buzzwords at the time, but it actually has sort of morphed into the truth where the conversation, it's still not like there's this idea, oh, Twitter is the public sphere. No, it's a particular slice of it for people who want to engage. But it's the people who, you know, in the comments you would always get like the corrections, you know, in the comments, or you get somebody who expands your story in some way, or a conversation that yields something interesting.
It's still not the perfect, it's not like the platonic ideal, as it were, of, you know, of perfect conversation and perfect equality between writer and audience, and everyone is able to say what they feel and no one feels like they're, you know, being drowned out or not being heard.
Yeah.
But it's getting there. It's pretty much the closest thing we've got. I don't know about you, but anytime anyone asks me, so what's going to replace Twitter? I always have to pause and say, I'm not really sure, because I can't really figure out how you could do better what it is that Twitter does. It's an astonishingly simple idea.
Because it's not about adding something. It's about the fact that it's so
streamlined. Yeah. And so at its heart, it is such a minimalist idea. It's really difficult to see how, from a journalist perspective at least, how you could improve upon that.
More than anybody else that comes to mind, like, I can make the case that, okay, so it's great to like, whatever, promote your content on Twitter, then it becomes this glorified, like, oh, it's letters to the editor, but a response. Or it's a reporting tool where you're actually getting information from, you know, some sort of, you know, crowdsourced journalism, hive mind thing. It's also a good reporting tool to ask people questions in public. Sometimes they'll answer questions they wouldn't otherwise, you know, and
shame tweets.
Shame tweets is how I get most of my interviews.
Nothing like a good shame tweet.
That's how I book. But all of that sort of imagines that you're using a reporting tool and then you go report in a newspaper. Mm-hmm. And more than anyone else, and I would actually be curious to know on like a measurable level, when you are reporting, when you, Katie O'Malley, are reporting on Twitter, you might be reaching a larger audience than when you file paragraphs in the newspaper.
Entirely possible. You know how Twitter is. You can have a follower, but who knows if that follower is logged in the last 6 months. So it becomes really difficult to actually, you know, to know how many people you're talking to. And plus, people, you know, I don't know about you, but I follow, how many people do I follow? I think I follow about 900 people.
Yeah.
I mean, I use lists because I'm not insane. So I'm able to, you know, kind of keep some tabs on it, but I'm sure I miss stuff. So you can never be exactly sure how many people are going to be paying attention to what you're saying, but you should always assume that. You should always treat Twitter as if, you know, don't say anything so stupid that you're going to be like, oh, I didn't realize anyone was going to be paying attention.
Oh, yeah, no,
you're
it's
always
public.
Always just assume that when you're reporting that, plus people do go back and they look at it again, or something gets retweeted and it, you know, you can never
really
control.
Part of the public record.
Exactly. You can never really know. And when you're reporting, always, you know, try to keep that in mind. You know, for obvious reasons.
Probably depends on what you have to say. I mean, you've got 65,000 followers on Twitter, and people often make the mistake of thinking you've got 65,000 readers. Mm. You might have a lot fewer, you might have a lot more, because depending on the tweet, you know, probably like something under 10% will read that any given tweet. But if you report something important, then
suddenly it goes everywhere,
You could be retweeted. And, you know, Twitter gives you these diagnostics. I don't know if they give everybody this or just verified people. Sorry, plebes. Maybe everybody gets this and I'm just a dick. But they, I don't know how they figure it out, but they tell you, well, this tweet got read this many times.
I don't super understand that, and I try really hard not to look at it. I was the person who turned off all of my – I don't look at – like, on my client, I can't see how many followers anyone has because I realize that I might be subconsciously giving more weight to people with, you know, like – 500 followers as opposed to 2?
Subconsciously.
Yeah.
If somebody says something shitty about me and they've got 100,000 followers,
egg,
I'm paying more attention to that.
I really want to like try to, you know, treat everyone's views as equal as far as that goes.
Everyone's views aren't equal. And not based on how many followers they have.
Some eggs probably have super smart things to say and some blue checks don't. So you cannot go by this alone. You need to.
No, I think that not all views are equal, but a follower count is a pretty lousy way of measuring whether or not you need to listen to somebody.
Yeah. Probably, yeah.
Back when we were at McLean's, they actually, for a brief period of time, let us writers look at the stats.
Oh, that was the worst.
Yeah, I can't decide. I can't make up my mind. Like, I think that writers should have some idea as to whether or not their stuff is getting read or not, but I think that making it like...
It's painful. Well, it's thankfully, well, when I was at McLean's, it wasn't so... What is it? Is Chartbeat is the one they use now, which will tell you like at what point in an article people stopped reading, which is like
God.
The most disheartening thing. Thankfully, I never actually get to see this because it would you know, probably horrify me.
Head
and just
lead.
Turn off the internet forever.
Yeah. In general, back in those days, 2006-ish, a big but not huge McLean story online would get like 10,000 views. And I'm sure you routinely have tweets that, you know, I realize this at a certain point that like the social media audience may be overtaking the other audience.
It's true, but since we all need to eat, we've got to figure out some way of balancing the two.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that Post Media just today announced that they killed their tablet. Mm-hmm. I mean, even as the Star is pumping millions into their tablet project. We'll see how that goes. As who, the Citizen had a tablet magazine, is that right?
Yes.
I think they were getting like about 8 downloads a day or something like that.
I honestly don't know, but I get the impression that, you know, yeah, the decision was made to, you know, make the app the central focal point for online news, which does kind of make sense.
Yeah. And they killed it today.
Yes, they're all dead.
Yeah.
RIP tablets.
This is how we're going to monetize online. Doesn't look like it's going to.
Well, the thing is, you can monetize the apps to an extent if you get your little clicky ads in them. I think the tablet thing, and again, this is just based on kind of what I've heard and what I've seen, the issue is it's not even so much tablet editions, it's tablet themselves. Phones are getting so powerful that people are almost like, well, I don't really need my tablet anymore, I can actually just use my phone. So doing something that's designed particularly for that slightly larger interface isn't always worth it, because you can get people with phones, it can be much more... it can be a much more streamlined and sort of minimalist display. It can work on sort of, it can be platform agnostic, and you can get a lot more readers that way, and people do seem to like it. Like, I think, I do wonder if, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, iPads are seen as sort of, you know, a quaint relic of the past, like desktops.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, remember when we used to have tablets? Oh, man. And everyone will just have their phones that are basically the equivalent thereof and can also happily serve as phones.
Well, it's pretty similar to our Twitter conversation. Like, oh, what can we add to this? You know, can it be bigger? And advertisers love, oh, I want to have video on it. I want to have a... It's like, no, it's actually like the phone is the killer thing because it's simple. It fits in my pocket. It does all these different things.
Exactly.
And that's bad news for, like, they were able, whereas a banner ad or an ad that's delivered over a mobile phone gets a fraction of what a newsprint ad would get, the tablet ads are getting like 2 or 3 times.
And see, that's where the, in some senses, yes, I'm sure, you know, we in the media probably have to take some of the blame for the state of our industry. But at the same time, I do look at sort of ad values of eyeballs and shares and printed. It does seem very out of whack to me. Like, it really seems as if there's some holdovers from days when, you know, a wee little, you know, eighth of a page ad in a Globe and Mail was worth so much more than a thing on the Globe and Mail front page. Well, you know, eyeball-wise, you're probably getting pretty equivalent. Yeah. And I feel like the value hasn't, those prices and those values haven't really shifted. When that happens, you may see online news becoming a lot more viable. I think we just have to kind of see if we can survive until then.
Yeah. You know, I think about this a lot, about how much of the newspaper business has always been about the emotions and egos of advertisers. Because the position that the newspaper had is like, this is what's happening today. And if I turn to page 4 of what's happening today, I see my product. I am what's happening today.
You are the exciting thing. You are the thing that all eyeballs are going to be on.
And then you've got this internet where there's a million different things people could click on. And what are you? You're a banner at the top of some articles on one of those sites. Like, it's...
It doesn't feel as tangible.
No, and you may actually be reaching way more people, and you may actually be able to target it to the right people.
I legit click on ads sometimes and buy things. Like, it has happened. This is a thing that has happened. I have actually done this. And I can't click on my newspaper yet.
But doesn't that lead you to this like conclusion that advertising was never actually about selling stuff as much as it was, or maybe a large overvalued part of it was just that, like, making brands feel good about themselves?
And also I think the advertising industry also likes to make money and to exist and to continue to present itself as viable. So they have to kind of act as the middleman and convince both sides that, you know, they're very necessary.
Yeah. So I can't tell if online ads are undervalued or if newspaper ads were for decades and decades.
Hugely overvalued. I don't know. I suspect it's somewhere in the middle, and I suspect it will eventually kind of level out to something approaching a, you know, realistic number on all sides. The issue is going to be, can, you know, we actually survive till then?
Yeah. Are you addicted to this stuff? I mean, it feels like, I'm trying to think of the right analogy here. If you're predisposed to have an addictive personality and somebody introduces you to crack, if you were already a news reporter and then somebody introduces social media and Blackberries, is this just like a bad alchemy?
Bad alchemy. I think that
crackheads love crack.
Crackheads do love crack, and I bet they have excellent defense for it. No, I mean, I think from a reporter's perspective, the idea of being able to report what's going on to a virtually limitless audience in theory, as it happens, without going through any kind of filter at all, is, that's kind of the essence of journalism. Yeah. The idea of being able to share. The first time I really, really realized the power and how sort of vital that can be was actually during the G8/20 in Toronto, because that was a perfect example of, you know, events transpiring everywhere that, yeah, I mean, you know, you could send your files and you could, and people obviously did file, but if you had a, I was working at CBC at the time, if you had a camera, you were a target for like everyone, because you're very visibly media. You have a, you're either standing by a truck that says CBC on it, or you've, you know, got a camera and a crew. It's very obvious who you are. If you're just tweeting and reporting via your phone, you could be anyone, which means you can go anywhere, which means you're far less likely to be, you know, to be sort of centered out as media. It really allows you to almost be incognito. And that was, to me, was just, during that particular context, that was really important.
Oh, you're not answering my question
at all.
What
was the question? Sorry, honestly.
No, you're making a wonderful argument, like just sort of practically, this is, it's a wonderful reporting tool. It lets you go incognito. It lets you, like, there's no filter. Yeah. It's great. What I'm talking about is you have tweeted 194,000 times. You've had something to say on Twitter 194,000 times. So I'm not good at quick math, but if you're filing stories, I think you're at some small fraction of that. Like, what's your dog's name?
Blackberry.
Your dog's name is Blackberry.
Her name is Blackberry. Yes, it's true. That's more my addiction to my phone, technically.
Right. Are you an addict? Is this? How does this affect you on a personal level?
I'm just trying to think. I love visual. Oh, I will put my phone away. Like my. I'm an e-text reader. I gave up on the hard copy books, but I read on an actual Kindle. It is not a Kindle that is attached to the internet in any way other than books go on it. There is no email. There is no web.
Yeah.
If I'm sitting there, and I love reading, when I'm reading my book, it's just me and my book.
There is an addictive quality to having something that nobody else in the world knows about and having to tell everybody about it. You know, being the intermediary, being a reporter, there's juice there.
Absolutely. But I think that's been the case as long as, you know, we had pens.
I know. But the process just got like.
Yeah, much quicker.
Yeah. We went from like Tylenol 3s to I'll keep going back to the hard narcotics. But it really, like, you could just constantly be reporting now.
It's true. But, you know, I would go crazy if I spent all of my time reporting, because sometimes you actually have to, you know, tune it off and, you know, go watch Netflix or go for a walk.
And you can do that with your e-reader
just get out, just go do something entirely different from reporting. You're right. You do need to be able to put down the tool. I remember that while I use Twitter for reporting and for work, I also just kind of enjoy it as a person. Like it's also my personal account.
It blurs that stuff because it kind of feeds into your personal life, and you're joking with people, and it's riffing. It's a lot of fun, and you're talking to fellow travelers who are obsessed with the same things that you are.
Yeah, which I not seeing a problem. Like, I actually think that's as long as you're doing it within limits, and as long as, you know, you see the sunshine occasionally, your dog gets walked, you interact with human beings.
Yeah, no, I think you answered my question. So why'd you leave the CBC? The Post Media might not be around soon. CBC, whatever else happens. So, well, Justin's going to give him $100 million back, so CBC's going to be around.
And they deserve it. CBC's an excellent institution.
I want them to have it. We'll see if they deserve it.
Honestly, I really did love my time at CBC, but I get itchy feet, and the Citizen offer came along. It was basically like a dream job. It came along at exactly the time when I was starting to think, ugh, maybe it's time to sort of stretch my legs, do something else. And it was just sort of a serendipitous series of events. I wasn't, you know, looking for another job. It just happened along, and there it was, and I decided to take it.
Yeah. Are you worried about the future of Post Media?
You know, honestly, again, you know, as you said, Justin's going to give the CBC $100 million. When I was at CBC, it was during, you know, conservative years, where there was this constant threat that, you know, we were constantly losing money. They were constantly, the budget was being cut. And there was always a sort of specter in the background, like, and then, you know, they're going to privatize and sell the entire organization. So I don't think I'm any more worried than I was then. I think that working in this industry means you live in a perpetual state of not being sure that your profession is going to continue to be viable beyond, say, 6 months to a year. Honestly, maybe I'm in denial, but it's not actually much worse than Post Media.
I think there's going to be some form of news industry 10 or 20 years from now. And my
That'd
guess is that whoever's got 65,000 Twitter followers now probably has a place in it.
Or, you know, go work at Fancy Socks. I might be very good at that.
Fancy Socks?
You know, Fancy Socks. They sell sockware.
They sell fancy socks.
They do indeed.
Is the new boss any different than the old boss? Do you think that with Trudeau, the job of reporters is going to change?
Oh, God, I hope not.
I mean, well, we've talked a lot on Canada Land about just how difficult it was to get information out of...
I have a complex view on this.
Okay.
In one sense, I actually appreciated the fact that for the most part, with the now soon-to-be former PMO and government, there was no – when you don't call people up as a DCOM, if you don't sort of hand out favors and treat some reporters nicely as – you know, if you don't try to – if you don't have leverage, as in if you don't be nice to me, then I'm not going to be nice to you because you're not nice to anyone ever, it becomes a very freeing relationship from both sides. Because I – you know, there were many times where various directors of communication to the prime minister were very angry at me for various things. And maybe in a previous generation, I would be like, oh, no, now I won't get the scoop on such and such. And I will. Oh, this is terrible. Yeah. I better be nicer. In this case, it was like, wow, he's angry. Well, on to the next thing. Like, there's literally nothing you can lose at this point. I actually thought that was kind of freeing. Where it became ridiculous was when you couldn't get actual just factual information.
Yeah.
That wasn't even helpful to them.
Even when it was stuff that didn't hurt them in any way.
That just became, you know, sort of obstructionist for no good reason, only because the notion that there was a war suggests that our side, the media, was actually in any way interested in fighting. We never were. We were basically just like the conservatives got a morale boost in a lot of ways, I think, from going after the media in general. You saw that on the top with the fundraising letters and stuff.
But it would also
on a micro level, like some DCOMs really seem to hate journalists.
There is a war. Journalists are on a side, and the side is that we're trying to get information, and they're on the side of trying to not give us information.
Yeah, but there was this constant, you know, you would always see this, you know, PMO versus the press gallery, the next round. It was always like, well, we're not fighting back. We're basically just trying to do our job and sitting here and not, you know, lodging, you know, there's no Spartacus here. But it seemed like we were one of the easier things to go after if people were having, you know, a bad day in PMO or in the center. One thing that would never fail to kind of cheer them up seemed to be to occasionally make the media's life difficult. That was annoying. I would like to hope that perhaps that won't be the case, but I'm not going to count on it. I've gotten used to this adversarial relationship between us and the government. I don't think it's necessarily unhealthy. I think there are times when it just makes sense for both of us, for them to, you know, I don't know, perhaps provide copies of press releases instead of making us go find them on the website.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and also the one thing that I really do hope changes is let us talk to your experts. Let us talk to your civil servants who actually know stuff. Don't make me talk to a ministerial staffer who really doesn't have any more idea than what I know about this issue that I'm asking them and is just reading the talking points that were prepared to her by PCO, which were prepared by someone, the person who I should actually be talking to in the
first
place.
4 days after it was a news story.
Who can answer my question. So that is something I would like to see. But beyond that,
yeah, I can't tell if I should be depressed by what you just said, because, you know, the days when it was relationship dependent and it was a relationship management thing in which reporters are liked by government officials, like, there's a big problem with that.
Yes,
you know, and yet for everybody just to be reduced to like as a functionary, you know, like, I don't have to worry if you like me or not because you have your marching orders and you're not going to stray from them. Mm-hmm. I have mine, which is to try to rattle this out of you one way or the other. And that's just what we're going to do. Maybe it's more honest.
It would be – well, it would also be great if you could have a happy medium where it could be, you know, hey, you and I, we actually might, you know, go out and grab a beer together. But right now, I am trying to get this information. You are not giving it to me. This is work. Then, you know, everything else is separate. But I'm not going to stop doing my job. You're not going to stop doing your job. Simply because there's, you know, a friendliness there. Friendliness doesn't have to imply control.
Uh-huh.
You can, in fact, separate these, I think, these aspects.
Yeah. And I think you have to worry about being spun if you're too much of a friend.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's what I mean. That's why you have to separate them. And that's why you have to, you know, I do have, as I'm sure all journalists do, have, you know, friends in all parties. And they, you know, sometimes they'll say, like, here's our argument. And I will listen, but I'll say, like, are you just spinning me again? It's like, okay, no more spin. We're done. We're just moving on to a different issue. You have to always be aware for it. But
does that happen? Are you out, like, socially and you wonder if somebody's working some angle on you, like trying to, you know, slowly sway you or...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's deliberate, or do you think, I mean...
No, I don't think it's a sinister plot. I think that they genuinely believe what they're, you know, trying to say, and they really would like to persuade other people, ideally journalists who are writing about it and making their life difficult, of the rightness of their views. And there's nothing, you know, inherently wrong with that.
People do drink the Kool-Aid. If you're in the culture of a party, or if you're in the culture of an organization, you ultimately get passionate and convinced and swayed.
Well, and particularly, this is a self-selecting, in all political parties, the people who gravitate and who end up being staff and who end up working there all are, for the most part, people who did so and you know, started in the first place because they genuinely believe in what the party was doing. So, you know, in that sense, it's not even so much as they drank the Kool-Aid as they came you know, pre-drunk. They wanted to believe that's how they turned up, and now they're just going to, you know, bring the cause to the world.
And these are the people you choose to hang out with?
Well, some of them are. Well, the other ones are journalists, so, like, pick your poison.
Katie O'Malley, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That is your Canada Land Show. I hope you liked it. You can always email me. I am at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read them all and I respond when I can. I'm on Twitter at Jesse Brown. The website where we are breaking news stories all the time is at canadalandshow.com. The crowdfunding site is at patreon.com/canadaland. I make this show with Katie Jensen. The next episode of Canada Land Commons will be up on Tuesday, and the next episode of Shortcuts will be up on Thursday. If you like this show, please support it.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A couple of years ago, a cop was shot dead on a deserted pier in the tiny nation of Belize. The only other person there that night was a frightened young woman found covered in blood. By all appearances, it was an open and shut case. But not in Belize, where this woman was connected to a mysterious billionaire who basically runs the place.
Justice will not be served in this case. She's gonna get away with it.
Or will she? White Devil, a Campside Media original. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.